Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
I'm Carl Quintanilla. You're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in. Good Monday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla in New York. Julia Borstin's in Los Angeles. John Ford is in D.C. and Deirdre's off today. Elon Musk uses Twitter to decide, and it looks like he may dump a big chunk of Tesla stock. We'll tell you the real reason behind that sale next. Then we seriously consider Bitcoin hitting 70,000 intraday all-time high earlier. Another surge for crypto takes its total valuation above $3 trillion. And then later, PayPal expectations, software pops, and Walmart's Wall-E for delivery. First, though, some breaking news out of the Fed. Let's get to Steve Leisman. Steve?
Carl, thanks. Fed Governor Randy Quarles announcing he has submitted his resignation and it will be effective at the end of December. He joined the Fed in October 2017 as vice chair for banking supervision. He ends his four-year term as vice chair in October. That ended, and now he's on the board. This resignation highlights four jobs that President Biden has to fill or will have to fill in the coming months. We'll count them. The Quarles vice chair of banking supervision, vice chair for the Federal Reserve Board, Richard Clarida, his term ends in January. Of course, there's Jay Powell. His term ends in February as chair. And there is one unfilled spot. Just real quickly, we know that Fed Governor Lael Brainard and Fed Chair Powell were both seen at the White House last week. So we are waiting any day, any minute, any hour, any month, any week now, John, for the announcement of who will be the next Fed chair.
Yeah, and I know you'll be on top of it when we do here. Thank you, Steve Leisman. And now we are on track for more record highs today. The NASDAQ now up 26% year to date. But that's masking some very real pain we've seen in a few stocks in tech the last few weeks. While indices are at highs, there have been some sharp downward moves for individual stocks when growth disappoints. Zoom, Peloton, EdTech company Chegg, all been cut in half or more this year. Peloton and Chegg in particular hit hard after third quarter disappointments. October also especially rough on certain areas in social media that had had run-ups in valuation. I'm thinking Snap and Pinterest here, which are down 30 to 40% off their recent highs. So what's been winning? Well, a lot of everything else. Some of the back-end e-commerce names like Bill.com, that stopped tripling in the last 12 months. A few payments names like Affirm. Not the whole sector, though. Meanwhile, semiconductors continue to outperform and beat expectations. NVIDIA, Qualcomm, AMD have all shot higher. Guys, Julia, we were talking about this morning. It's interesting to see. Largely, things have moved higher, but there have been some stocks that have these massive runs on expectations that the world has changed. And, hey, maybe it has. But maybe not as quickly as bulls on these particular stocks had hoped. It reminds me, in a way, of stocks like Amazon, which had amazing runs when they were young, but then pulled way back during the dot-com bust. They pulled back too far. So I think for investors, they got to decide, is this a platform play? Is this really strong leadership? Is this a vision that's going to carry, or is it a flash in the pan?
And John, that really all comes down to what does the new normal look like, right? And how much of the trends that we saw accelerated during the pandemic, how many of those trends, whether it's fitness from home like Peloton or Chegg or some of these other plays like Pinterest, are these things that people adopted during the pandemic and are just going to continue using permanently? Or were they more things that really benefited from the pandemic and people may use, but not in the same sort of permanent, stable way that that a lot of these companies had hoped? So the growth will not be that sustained. But Carl, one thing I think that's notable when we look at this divergence within the tech sector is it just shows you how broad and diverse tech is itself. Tech is in everything we do, from advertising supported companies to these enterprise companies. And it really seems looking forward like the enterprise software play is going to be really what's benefiting, especially in 2022.
All right. It is fascinating. You're right about tech, Julia. I mean, it's so disparate. But we've been talking about this for a while now, the idea that all these dislocations out of COVID are going to last a lot longer than we think. Hybrid work changes moving patterns, so Zillow gets hurt. The job market's super strong, so enrollment goes down. And as you said, Chegg gets hurt. The reopening plays, the Rokus, the Disneys, the Comcasts are hurting as people leave the house. We're going to see how long it lasts.
Yeah, and of course, we can't underestimate how much some of those stocks did have a big run-up over the past year or so. Now, speaking of humbling bets on tech, SoftBank saw its first quarterly loss since the beginning of 2020. CEO Masayoshi blamed his Chinese investments, saying, quote, "We are right in the middle of a storm. The biggest strains on the company have been in e-commerce, with Alibaba, its biggest holding, falling 35% during the quarter, along with Coupang, which fell 33%. Didi's losses also weighing on the Vision Fund's performance. So, Carl, you got to wonder, this is a storm, but should they have been better prepared for this storm?
Meantime, shares of Tesla on the move this morning, thanks to Elon Musk, as you know by now, our Robert Frank explains. Robert?
Well, Carl, Tesla shares now down less than 3% for the day, despite Elon Musk's promise to sell over $20 billion in shares. Now, in a Twitter poll over the weekend, he asked whether he should sell 10% of his stake. 58% of voters supported a sale, but he was likely going to sell anyway. And that's because a 2012 compensation package granted him options on 23 million shares. Those options expire next August. So he has 9 months to exercise the options and pay the taxes. The tax bill, by the way, on these options, both federal and California, will be around $15 billion. Now, he can't borrow that much, so he was always going to have to sell shares to pay the IRS. Selling 10% of the company gives him about $20 billion. That's enough to pay the tax and maybe give to charity, which, by the way, could also help lower his tax bill. So where does this leave Elon Musk's stake in Tesla and his wealth? Well, he owns more than 20% of the company. He will own another 10 million shares after all this option exercising and taxes are paid. And his wealth has increased by $170 billion just this year. His total net worth right now, that's between the Tesla shares and his stake in SpaceX, now at $340 billion. He's now worth 1.5 times Jeff Bezos. By the way, Jeff Bezos has also sold about $20 billion of his shares this year and last, though we didn't hear much about it. And of course, he never tweeted about it. Guys?
Robert, speaking of these billion-dollar tweets, I mean, I think a week ago, Elon Musk tweeted something about $6 billion to fight hunger, kind of as a response to something that someone had said about billionaires. I mean, what do you think is the impact in public perception of the ultra wealthy, of, you know, him trying to democratize how much stock he sells or what he spends it on? Is this a savvy move?
I think the perception of the ultra wealthy by many, certainly in political circles and in D.C. lately, has been that they don't pay their fair share, that there was a year or two or maybe even a few where Elon Musk did not pay any income taxes. So the fact that he's paying taxes of up to $15 billion in one tax bill, I think, is going to slightly change or at least add to that debate. And the fact that he's going to perhaps give up to $6 billion to charity. We'll see what he does on that. Now, that does lower his tax bill, but still, that is a tremendous amount to give to charity. I think this is going to add at least a little more fuel to the other side of that debate, which is, hey, $15 billion in taxes is a lot, no matter how much you're worth.
Robert Frank, what a story from the weekend. Appreciate that and great piece today. Thanks very much. Stick with Tesla here. Bring in analyst Jed Dorsheimer from Canaccord, who did increase his target on the stock to 1040 from 940, keeps a buy rating. Also, Jefferies today ups its price target to a street high 1400 today. Jed, good morning. Good to see you.
Hey, good morning. Good to see you as well.
So increasingly, the sell side's been arguing this is a self-funded growth story. It's a revenue story. It's a margin story. How much gets complicated by a sale of stock by Musk?
I don't think any. I mean, from a fundamental perspective, I don't think it changes. If anything, I think through this strategy, if we can call it that, Musk has taken off the narrative that would have been purported of something wrong in Tesla that's causing him to, you know, exercise those options. So if anything, I would say it's a net positive.
What do you think the story is right now between Tesla's growth trajectory and the incoming wave of competition, some believe, from legacy OEMs? How much white space is there, and how much do you expect it to compress, if any?
Well, I think you're going to continue to see competition. However, having run a division of a Fortune 500 myself, I will say that what Wall Street still fails to understand, and most investors, is the role of culture. And the challenge that the traditional OEMs are going to have is not can you build a product that's as good as Tesla, but how do you change the culture that enables the ability to keep building products as good as Tesla? It's not one thing that the company does, but it's all these little things that add up to a big difference, starting with whether it's the battery technology, the 4680 that they're bringing in, or the inverter using silicon carbide. There's a lot of things that allow Tesla to maintain the advantage, and I still see that white space is pretty far.
Jed, it looks to me like price targets on Tesla keep going up because the stock keeps going up. And it seems like that's not how it's supposed to work. So what do you have to believe differently about Tesla to have, say, a 1400 price target on it versus, you know, what seemed like an ambitious, say, 1190 price target a couple years ago?
Yeah, I mean, remember, we were one of the first that came on with, I think it was, I put a price target of, I think, 500. And this was before the splits, where it looked at as crazy in the bulls on Tesla. You know, yeah, it's a little bit, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of the stock moving up and you see things follow. I think the net takeaway is you either believe that fundamentally Tesla has an advantage in the market and the market is shifting over to EVs. And beyond that, it's an energy story, which is kind of our thesis. And if you look at it that way, I think there's still room on this one.
Hey, finally, Jed, on chip shortages and supply crunch, so there was some work last week done on October global sales inching up just enough to make some argue that maybe autos would be the first industry to recover, not fully, but at least directionally start improving on supply. You agree with that?
Yeah, but I would say for Tesla, it really doesn't matter. I mean, one of the things that Elon did is reprogram the coding so that they wouldn't be exposed to the chips that were in shortage. That came out when Deese over at VW had Elon talk to VW. So we're seeing a lot of things that are just a bit out of the normal, and I think great for kind of leading this industry forward.
Jed, great stuff. Always good to check in with you. Jed Dorsheimer, Canaccord on
Thank
Tesla.
You.
Thanks.
And let's turn to Tinder. Co-founder Sean Rad is getting his day in court against IAC as opening statements of a high-profile lawsuit get underway this morning. Now, Rad, along with other early employees of Tinder, sued Match Group and its then-parent company, IAC. This lawsuit was filed 3 years ago. They allege that the companies controlled by Barry Diller cheated them out of $2 billion. That's how much they're looking for in damages. Now, at the heart of these allegations, Rad said that a $3 billion valuation that Match and IAC gave Tinder when they were calculating Rad and the other stock options was far less than the $13 billion that they say the company was really worth. Now, along with Sean Rad, we expect IAC Chairman Barry Diller and former Match Group and Tinder CEO Greg Blatt to testify in what should be about a three-week case. Carl, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And speaking of technology trends that have been accelerated during the pandemic, we've certainly seen the continued growth of digital dating in the last 3 years since this case was filed.
Yeah, fascinating. And John, I'm just trying to think the universe of examples where you had a co-founder go back and argue for a bigger share of what the pie eventually became. It's not unprecedented, but doesn't happen too often.
Yeah, and this dating business just seems to be so dirty. I mean, when you look at what happened with Bumble's founder in this group, and then Sean Rad said he was lots of accusations of cheating, just like real dating, I suppose. Maybe this will get sorted out. Meanwhile, remember Confluent, the stock went public earlier this year. We had the CEO on IPO day. Shares have more than tripled since then. CEO's back with us to talk earnings after the break. Stay with us.
Thank you. people today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation. Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Canva.
Time for a gut check, and today it is crypto. Early this morning, the overall market cap of all cryptocurrencies surpassed $3 trillion. Bitcoin is flirting with 70,000. We mentioned it earlier, but an intraday all-time high this morning. Ether is above $4,700 for the first time ever, up 500% this year alone, and it trickles down. The third and fourth biggest coins, Binance and Solana, have each added more than 20% in just the last 7 days. Top seven cryptos all in the green this morning. Guys?
Meantime, I got some news on Meta, formerly known as Facebook, announcing it is partnering with AMD to produce chips for the service. AMD is having a data center presentation today. You can see the stocks rocketing up here midday, up almost 7%, John, as we're seeing another use case for names and a sector that have been going parabolic in some cases.
Yeah, it just crossed AMD $100 a share, remember, earlier in the summer, and it's inching closer to Intel's market cap. It said, around $175 billion, I think. Intel's just over $200. Who'd have thought? There we are. Meantime, software stocks trading at all-time highs. One high-growth name, Confluent, closed up 27% Friday. The company reporting cloud revenue growth of 245%. Shares of Datadog also seeing a pop from earnings and some big growth numbers with results from Snowflake and MongoDB on deck. Joining us now is Confluent's co-founder and CEO, Jay Kreps. Jay, quite the growth numbers here. You seem to be on a beat and raise pattern. I've seen a few of those, but tell me about what kind of demand you're seeing. And from the customer side, what seems to be driving this outperformance?
Yeah, we were really happy with the results. You know, I think the big picture is it's a $50 billion market opportunity and category. And these cloud services are an amazing way of delivering new capabilities around data to companies. And, you know, I think that we're seeing really explosive uptake of that in our customer base.
And what about the customer add number? To what degree is your customer size and the size of the commitment shifting? I think you had about 190 customer adds in the past. You've had 290. You've had 440. What should we read into that?
Yeah, you know, we have a self-serve part of the product that tends to dominate that because people can show up and sign up. And we also have a sales team that goes out and closes deals. So, you know, depending on our tactics, it'll be higher or lower each quarter. But we were really happy with the growth that we saw.
And that's that kind of product driven, sales motion, similar to what we've seen from Atlassian, I think, which also had some big outperformance. To what degree is that going to be able to continue to drive growth as, you know, expectations rise, as those revenue numbers rise? How much do you think you're going to have to put more wood behind the arrow with the traditional sales force?
Yeah, it's really a mixture. And that's what I think you would see in Confluent or really any of these high growth software companies where, you know, there's a self-service aspect, there's a product-led growth side of this, but that works hand in hand with a sales team that can take the technology and make it something really strategic. You know, our goal with customers is to grow over time into a role where we're the central nervous system that connects all the different applications and SaaS layers and data systems. And to get there, you know, it's not just a matter of product-led growth. You need to interact and have strategic relationships at the company. And those two things really go hand in hand.
So, Jay, we were talking earlier this show about how some tech stocks have really seen this massive acceleration due to the pandemic and some of those changes in the way that people and companies interact. But I'm wondering if, as you look ahead to next year, how much you think you'll be able to maintain this growth rate and how much you think that perhaps some of the growth you saw this year was a pull forward, or whether or not these trends are going to be sustainable.
Well, the world of data and infrastructure, it does move a little bit slower. So, you know, maybe 3 days after the pandemic, the CEO buys Zoom. But it takes a little longer to shift the digital strategy. And I don't think that that's a shift that anybody wants to reverse. So we're seeing continued acceleration in investment in the digital side of businesses. I think because the reality is this is an investment that probably should have happened at this scale even before the pandemic. And that was kind of the nudge that got it started. And so we're very excited about what lays ahead.
I think that's interesting. I mean, the point that they're not done reinventing their digital infrastructure. But then, I mean, Jay, you look at like corporate sentiment or CFO sentiment is nowhere near what you would expect given the cash levels at the big companies. What do you think that says about pricing for cloud in the year ahead?
Yeah, I mean, look, the area of cloud has gotten competitive. There's multiple cloud providers. I think the reality is this is such a better deal as a way of getting data capabilities and trying to hire a team of high-end engineers to run software in your data centers. That's a very expensive proposition, and it's gotten more expensive as the cost and demand for engineers has gone up, which is something you know, any company that employs software engineers is facing. And that's really, I think, even accelerated the rise of these cloud services, which allow you to do more with the people you have and have them focus on the part of the business that really differentiates you.
Jay, finally, talk strategy a little bit for us. Maybe demystify this for investors. You talked about stream convergence. What's the strategic importance of that as customers want to do more, have more insight into their data?
Yeah, the area we're in is all around streaming and data in motion. And so there's been a huge category of data, but it's mostly been about storage, like your data warehouse. Where's the warehouse where you keep all the data, you know, in boxes to look it up at the end of the day and run a report? But increasingly, the use of software and data is to run the business. It's about the operational side, powering, you know, real live use cases, interactions with customers, logistics. And this is what data in motion is about. It's not just the data at rest. It's actually connecting all the parts of the business and being able to act on whatever's happening in real time. And this is something that's been adopted by organizations like Walmart or Citigroup or even the CDC to be able to track activity around the pandemic.
Well, makes sense. What, then while we're seeing so much growth, thank you, Jay. Jay Kreps, CEO of Confluent.
Cramer's been adding to PayPal ahead of earnings, but should you? We'll tell you what to expect this afternoon. Plus, a new tie-in for Square as Tech Check is back after this.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Canva. Welcome back to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Julia Borsten and John Fort. NASDAQ's looking for its 11th straight session in the green. Plus, take a look at AMD surging on news of a new partnership with Meta. AMD and NVIDIA set up for some competition in that space. Both stocks are up better than 40% in just the last month. And watch Coinbase today as well, up almost 7%. A lot of movers today, not necessarily on some news, but they will have earnings on that later in the week. Let's get a news update with Rahel Solomon. Hi, Rahel.
Hi, Carl. Good morning. And here's what's happening at this hour. Caterpillar leading the Dow Industrials after the House of Representatives passed the Democrats' infrastructure bill. Baird also calling Caterpillar a fresh pick because the bill will drive equipment sales for years. Beauty company Coty seeing its shares jump 12%. Quarterly profits more than doubled forecast with help from cost cuts and price increases. The maker of brands including Kylie Cosmetics and Max Factor says that travel retail is coming back. Coty also optimistic about rising sales tied to workers returning to work. And Live Nation shares falling as much as 8% this morning before rebounding. Live Nation was the promoter for Travis Scott's Astroworld Festival on Friday, where 8 people died. Multiple lawsuits have been filed against Live Nation. NBC News now says that Scott plans to provide full refunds to everyone who bought tickets for the festival. Scott also canceling a concert appearance in Las Vegas this weekend, with sources saying that he is too distraught to play. Julia, I'll send it back to you.
Thanks, Rahel. And let's get back to the market and the melt-up rally we've seen in stocks. The S&P now up 7 sessions in a row and on track to make today number 8. Mike Santoli here with us on the all-important question, can it continue?
Julia, we know it can because it has in the past continued higher after we've gotten some of these overheated readings, the ones we're seeing right now. Very hot streak, 7 days up for the S&P 500, 16 of 18. Keep kind of reciting all these statistics because it does show you that the market has been on a really strong run that you don't see very often. This, however, shows the semiconductor group against the NASDAQ composite. Semi's very interesting here because, of course, on one hand, it's a gauge of cyclical expectations. Usually it's a really good sign when semis are outperforming, and they really are outperforming right now. On the other hand, this latest move higher in the group has largely been about NVIDIA, AMD to a lesser extent, those two together, about 15% of this index, things like Intel, Broadcom, Qorvo, Skyworks, not really helping things out. So it is a pretty unique thing, NVIDIA becoming much more of a retail favorite and kind of a story stock as opposed to necessarily being something about the cyclical expectations. Now, what is a real historic melt-up look like? Take a look at this year's NASDAQ composite run relative to what we saw in the calendar year 1999. Some of the similarities here along the way was kind of this rolling rally with an upside bias and some pullbacks up until you got into the fourth quarter, and then it was just liftoff. So you were basically right here in early November, and it went wild from there. Another little tidbit, in the 2 years ending this past Friday, the NASDAQ was up 89%. In the 2 years ending November 5th, the same date in 1999, NASDAQ composite up 89%. That's nothing like a prediction of what can happen. But if you think today is crazy, it's not really crazy. It's just getting a little bit ahead of itself, guys.
A lot of folks who watch right now might not remember those days, Mike. Yeah. Fascinating. Thanks, Mike Santoli. One mover to watch after the bell tonight is PayPal. Strong earnings out of Square, even its short-lived acquisition target Pinterest, setting the bar there. But is the selling overdone? Darren Peller covers fintech for Wolfe Research and joins us this morning. Hey, Darren, good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
When do you think PayPal can sort of shake off that Pinterest report?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of investors really want to see that fundamentals are still really strong first, and hopefully we'll get some of the sense of that tonight. And then I think some long-term investors really want to check in with management again after that, those headlines, and kind of just take their pulse on what their M&A strategy really is before they get back into the stock in a big way.
Do you think it's specific to PayPal, or are there sort of lingering curiosities about models at Square and maybe some of the legacy credit card processors?
Look, that's a great point. I mean, there's been a real bifurcation across the fintech universe for investors looking at the new names and what are a lot are considering the legacy stocks. But look, the good news, I think, for Square and for PayPal is I think most investors would put them in that winner's camp, considering they have everything from buy now, pay later to crypto. They're a digital wallet. They really check a lot of the boxes. So I think they'll get the benefit of the doubt, unlike some other stocks that have been struggling along that way. But they really do have to show the numbers. And I think, again, I think investors really want to get a sense of what their strategy is in terms of M&A and capital allocation now.
Darren, what is the significance of those Pinterest headlines from days, from weeks ago to you? I mean, it seems to me for PayPal, there's so much work to do, potentially in brokerage, in small business banking. So many, I mean, you know, Stripe has so much growth already, and PayPal could compete with that. I was confused about why they would even consider doing it. Is that some of the explanation that you were talking about that analysts might want?
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, they have a lot that they're doing already. There's a super app that they're really trying to upgrade to provide a lot more capability around their digital wallet. So I think investors didn't think they necessarily needed such a big acquisition of a company that a lot of investors feel kind of questionable about right now. But, you know, I think what's happening is management is a very forward looking management team here. Dan Schulman is really a visionary around fintech. And he sees a convergence between fintech and social commerce, like we see with Facebook, for that matter, right? I think he's trying to look ahead a little bit, but investors really want to see execution on the current opportunities now as well.
Yeah, speaking of the current opportunities, Darren, I'm wondering what numbers you're most interested in when we get those earnings tonight. I mean, if you look at Square, we saw a deceleration of the Cash App. Do you think we'll see something similar in PayPal? I know there's been some question about whether there's been a slowdown in downloads of the PayPal app. What are the numbers you're watching for an indicator of what's ahead?
It's a great point. You know, look, the very important KPIs for PayPal are the net new actives that are added, along with TPV, the volume growth rate that we pretty much always look for in terms of quarterly and annual results. The company's talked about there being anywhere from 52 to 55 million and, you know, new actives added during 2021. And so for this quarter, we're hoping they can be roughly in line with that, let's call it 13 to 14 million range, to get us to skew up to that level for the full year. But as you said, some of the app downloads have been a little light. Now, churn has also been down a lot, so we still think they should be in line with those numbers. And then when it comes to TPV growth, we're still looking for very strong growth, albeit against tougher comps. But net-net, listen, PayPal's still a 20% plus compounder from our perspective, still in the winners camp. So I think these data points are a little bit more for the short-term investors, check the box. But long-term, really, it's more about the strategy that they want to check the box on before, you know, getting back in a big way.
Hey, finally, for the space at large, we're watching a lot of pictures this morning of international visitors coming back into the United States for the first time in 19 months. Do you think cross-border is going to be material for the sector at large?
Oh, my God. It's a huge opportunity. When you consider Visa and MasterCard, we've talked about this before, but almost all of the key names in our coverage universe have an extremely, you know, important exposure from cross-border because it's such a monetizable, high-yielding transaction. Visa, MasterCard, we've said 40% of their legacy revenues is cross-border generated, even though less than 10% of their volume is cross-border. So when that comes back, if it's still only at about 80 to 90% of 19 levels, and really 60 to 70% travel versus 19, right, that could be a big, big tailwind for those stocks, among many others in our coverage.
Darren, appreciate it so much. Good to see you. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Got some cybersecurity news here. Charges have been unsealed against a man accused of some of the worst ransomware attacks we saw over the summer. Eamon Jabbers, you've got that for us. Eamon?
John, that's right. Federal prosecutors unsealing these charges this morning. The Department of Justice has a press conference scheduled at 12:30 Eastern time, so we may get more detail on this. But what we know from the charges that have been unsealed right now from reporting from NBC's Pete Williams is that the man who is involved here is named Yaroslav Vasinsky. He's 22 years old. He's a Ukrainian, and he was arrested while trying to cross the Polish border at the request of U.S. authorities. They're now saying that they're seeking his extradition. Court documents unsealed Monday accused him of conducting around 2,500 ransomware attacks, including that Kaseya attack earlier in the year, which was one of those supply chain hacks where they get into one company and then from there get into additional companies. In that case, they requested a $70 million ransom. Now federal prosecutors are saying this is the man responsible, and they're seeking to bring him to justice. So we should have more detail on that once we hear from the Department of Justice at 12:30 East Coast time. John, back over to you.
Wow, 2,500. That is a lot. Eamon Jabbers, thank you. Meantime, keep your eye on these electric vehicle charging stocks, getting a nice boost thanks to the infrastructure bill. Why Needham is saying this basket is a buy today. That's on CNBC Pro, so check it out. We are back in just a moment. Let's get back to that AMD news that now has that stock up more than 11%. That's news that it's going to partner with Meta, Facebook, to supply new data center chips. Bernstein, Stacey Rasgon joins us now with more. And Stacey, it's not just about Facebook. Also, Azure implied here. But, I mean, we knew that AMD was making gains in this arena. This is a big jump for that news, isn't it? What else is behind this?
So there's always been this, you know, hesitancy, you know, to believe in terms of how far AMD can go. And, you know, the fact that they just announced Facebook, and Facebook, you got to remember, gave an enormous CapEx guide for next year. So I think people are believing that maybe this could be meaningful as we get into next year. They also said that they're in place, and I think with the 10 of the top 11 hyperscalers. So their breadth across the cloud space seems to be growing massively, right? They announced Microsoft Azure. They also gave updates to their GPU roadmap. They gave some, you know, they talked about the Frontier supercomputer. They talked about new offerings for accelerated compute that could compete against NVIDIA. And so it wasn't just Facebook, but I think Facebook is sort of forming the linchpin of like a number of announcements here that are helping to fuel and support like the long-term data center story for these guys. Like, it looked pretty good.
Stacey, AMD looks to me to be at around 180-plus billion market cap. Intel's just at around 208, 209.
Yeah.
You know, AMD just crossed 100 a share a few months ago. It's now at 150 today. At what point does a further bet on upside for AMD just simply become a bet against Intel doing any better than it is right now?
Well, I mean, in some sense, it already is. So, like, if you're comparing AMD and NVIDIA, for example, I mean, NVIDIA is just seeing some similar trends on the stock price right now. NVIDIA out there is they're creating new markets, right? And so with NVIDIA, it's a question of, like, how big can you dream the TAM for these new markets can be, and you can be as bullish as you want. For AMD, it has been a share gain story, right? Now, the advantage is their share is still low. I mean, even today, I mean, they're only sitting about 10% market share in servers, maybe 20%, a little under in client CPU. So there's a lot of headroom to go. So it becomes a question of how much you can believe. And at some point, yeah, I think you're right. It becomes a question of how well can they do against Intel. If you look at the real bulls on AMD, by the way, you talk to them, and I do. I mean, a lot of them have some very aggressive share numbers if you're looking out in the long term. I mean, you know, there's plenty of people out there that might have, you know, 40 or 50% market share for these guys versus where they are right now. And again, I don't know. I mean, it's aggressive, but it's not completely insane to put it like in the spreadsheet, whereas, you know, 18 or 24 months ago, you might have been insane to put that in there. It's not entirely crazy to think what could be possible today.
Yeah, Stacey, as we see those AMD shares up over 10%, I'm curious if you see other stocks in your universe that you cover that could be beneficiaries of what I see as this new land grab. You know, we used to talk of the streaming wars. Now it's the meta wars. And I'm wondering, as we see more headsets built, you know, we have the Apples and Googles of the world investing in this space, as well as the video game companies. Which of your other companies could really benefit from this?
You bet. So obviously it's the NVIDIAs and the AMD a little bit that in my world that are ripping. I think one sort of sleeper, but if you want to play the metaverse, and I'm not exactly sure what to make of the metaverse thesis at this point, so we'll see. But if you wanted to play that theme, I think an underappreciated one may actually be Qualcomm. Because you can imagine, I mean, they're already in a lot of like the AR and VR kind of headsets, and you can imagine needs not just for like really power efficient display and edge compute, but also connectivity, right? And so I think Qualcomm is one, if you're looking to play a stock that could in theory benefit from a metaverse story where there's probably absolutely nothing priced into it, it's probably Qualcomm.
It sounds like you're saying this rising tide of this new use case that we're getting familiar with, Stacey, is going to start to lift more boats.
I don't know. Like I said, I'm not entirely sure what to make of the metaverse. Now, you have to be careful. Even though I'm a semiconductor analyst, I am a little bit of a Luddite. So I'm not exactly sure what to make of this yet. but to the extent that this is becoming a bigger narrative, and we'll see how it plays out. I mean, this sort of stuff will take a while to play out. We'll see. But as long as the narrative itself is being shaped, there are a number of names probably that could benefit from the narrative that probably are not right now, at least. And Qualcomm probably is one of those.
Yeah, it's amazing, Stacey. Metaverse seems to be taking a bunch of stuff these companies couldn't sell before on AR and VR, calling it Metaverse, and now it's got a narrative.
That's not unusual, right? I mean, sometimes it takes things a while to find an actual use case, right?
Yeah, let's see if they sell. That'll be important. Stacey, thank you. Up next, the Substack CEO is going to talk about Facebook's original sin as he sees it. More Tech Check is straight ahead. Stay with us.
Some news today in the robot delivery world. Autonomous delivery company Serve Robotics announcing an expanded partnership with Uber this morning to bring on-demand robotic delivery to Uber Eats customers. The robotic delivery service will launch in Los Angeles early next year. I spoke with a co-founder and CEO, Dr. Ali Kashani. He says the robots are not only efficient, but can make delivery more cost-effective and environmentally sustainable. That full interview is up on our Twitter feed at CNBC Tech Check.
Yeah, and speaking of delivery, new this morning, Walmart making an announcement around a fully autonomous delivery vehicle. Frank Holland has that. Frank, this seems like maybe the beginnings of a solution to that trucker shortage.
Yeah, you know what? Good morning to you, John. Walmart's hoping it's the beginning of a way to ramp up their grocery delivery business. Now, keep this in mind. Walmart's the nation's biggest grocer. $208 billion in grocery sales last year, and now they're trying to gain even more market share by using these fully autonomous, completely driverless trucks to move online grocery orders. So Walmart's partnered up with Gaddick. That's a startup focused on middle-mile, business-to-business trucking. They're using gas-powered trucks that operate 12 hours daily. Those trucks are loaded up at warehouses called dark stores. They then travel to neighborhood market locations. They get unloaded, and then they go back for a 7-mile round trip. Now, aiming to improve efficiency, Walmart's moving to a hub-and-spoke model, operating smaller warehouses that are closer to their customers. That requires more restocking. And you have to remember, traditionally, grocery is a very thin margin business. And that's largely why Kroger is testing autonomous last mile delivery. They're doing this with a company called Noro in the Houston area and also using automated warehouses to offer online grocery to in places where Kroger doesn't actually have any stores. Albertsons is also using remote control delivery with a startup called Tortoise. Tortoise says a grocer can save approximately 60% on delivery costs using their tech. Wedbush forecasts $750 billion in spending on commercial autonomous vehicles by 2027. If you're looking to invest in that trend, there's two stocks you can look at right now, Aurora and TuSimple. Other companies, Plus and Embark, they're going to reportedly complete SPAC mergers later this year. We included the tickers of the SPAC there on the screen. Julia, back over to you.
Amazing to see those robots in action. Thanks so much. And watch Disney today. You've got earnings coming up on Wednesday afternoon, but this morning it is offering a discount for Disney Plus in an effort to boost subscribers, offering 1 month for $2. The stock is up about 0.5% this morning, and Tech Check is back in a moment.
Take a look at some of the top gainers on the NASDAQ. AMD is going to be right at the top, almost up better than 9%, as we've been discussing, because of this new partnership with Meta. But Xilinx, NVIDIA at number two and number three. What a morning, Julia, and what a week it's going to be from an event standpoint for the chips.
Yeah, and speaking of Meta, investors are still focused on how exactly Facebook and other social media companies could be regulated. Chris Best, who founded Substack, has a new op-ed arguing moderation can't save internet companies, saying Facebook is, quote, captive to that original sin of the internet, the ad-based business model. Chris Best, the co-founder and CEO of Substack, joins us now. Chris, I'm so glad to have you here today. Lay out your argument about why Facebook is so fundamentally flawed just because it relies on advertising.
I think this is the basic problem with not just Facebook, but kind of the first generation of social media companies, is the business model that worked when they were coming up was advertising. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It wasn't like an evil choice for them to make. But the way that that played out, the way that that business exists now, where they become this tremendous machine for printing money because they have this huge share of the advertising market, and all of the users, all of the people that use these services to talk to each other, to talk to their friends, to understand their culture, are not really part of the main economic deal that those services provide. And so you have these companies that exist to help people sell pizza ovens or car insurance or whatever, trying to regulate speech. It's a mad situation to be in to begin with.
But Chris, fundamentally speaking, you can't move the whole internet to a subscription-only model because then it would exclude a huge amount of people who can't afford to pay. Are you saying that there shouldn't be any ad-supported models on the internet?
I'm certainly not saying there shouldn't be any ad-supported models. I do think that subscription models can be powerful even for people who don't pay. One of the great things about subscription models is you can have a lot of content that exists outside of the paywall that people can see and they can, you know, pay to support or not pay and still get the benefit of. But I think fundamentally it's about giving readers and consumers a real choice over how to spend their attention. I think people are waking up to the idea that if I'm spending all of my time, all of my life on some feed that exists, you know, to sell me stuff, that might just be a bad choice.
Chris, how much work do you still have to do in figuring out how to make the subscription model work for great content creators? And Casey Newton is a contributor to CNBC. He's also got Platformer on Substack, and he shared, you know, churn is real. Subscribers don't just show up even when you're producing great content, exclusive interviews. It seems that there are mechanics here that Substack can work on to reduce churn, increase subscribers, and it varies from how it's going to work for journalism versus for comics, right? And you're working on all these different areas.
Totally. I think we're actually just at the very start of what I think will be a sea change in how we think about paying for culture on the internet. And I think Substack is just one piece of a broader shift that the world is becoming ready for. People are ready to pay for things that they care about, ready to be thoughtful about how they're spending their lives and who they trust to get their information from. And I think there's a long way to go, but the basic models that we have today are working astoundingly well. It's working great.
So do you have a priority for, say, journalism versus serialized books? Or, say, comics, or are you trying to do it all? Because it seems like there are different types of investments that would be necessary for each.
Well, we at Substack are kind of focusing on what we think of as, you know, any kind of person that has a unique perspective to bring. Anybody who I kind of want to invite into my life and give a slice of my time to subscribe to, so that they can sort of help filter the world and help me understand the world around me. And I think that journalism is obviously a big part of that, but also, you know, fiction, also other types of art and culture fit that bill. So we're not really focused on one narrow slice of, oh, it's journalist or it's fiction. It's more about this kind of model of an independent writer who is helping curate how I see the world.
Chris, Charlie Wartell, who writes A Galaxy Brain, he wrote an explanation of why he is moving from Substack over to The Atlantic after previously being at The New York Times and moving to Substack. As you see companies like Facebook introduce free versions of what you're doing with their bulletin, do you think that your model is going to be under attack and able to survive when you see people like Charlie Wartell leaving the platform?
I actually think when you see companies like Facebook copying what we've done at Substack, it's not that the model is under attack. It's a sign that the model is working and that other companies are seeing this thing that's happening and kind of wanting to get a piece of the action. I do think that the central to Substack is the idea of putting, you know, respecting people's attention, putting the readers and the writers in charge. And if you are a company that has the business model of Facebook, that's just going to be impossible to do.
Well, Chris, certainly an interesting time for the industry and fascinating op-ed. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Going to be a very busy week earnings-wise. Tonight we're going to get Roblox, AMC, PayPal, Zynga. We're going to watch for that. John, the events in semis this week, AMD, we mentioned, of course, this hour, Microchip later on this afternoon, Broadcom on Tuesday, NXPI on Thursday. As we're going to get a good look at how some of these use cases evolve given new technologies.
We didn't get a chance to talk about it much today, Carl, but I'm curious about this interaction between AMC and Disney with this Disney Plus Day happening on Friday and these sort of random movies, Disney movies are going to pop up at AMC theaters. That's interesting, but this is when Disney Plus meets Amazon Prime. I'm eager to see how that works out, Carl.
Yeah, Julia, we didn't really talk about Disney Plus Day or how Eternals did or how the return of international traveler is going to change dynamics of the theme park. But that's a discussion for Wednesday night. It does it for Tech Check. You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball! or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.